Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world all around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. We really appreciate it. Let people know about the program if you enjoy it. That's how these things grow. Coming up on this week's program, how humans came to walk upright. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter, @NewstalkScience. We get to all of those comments at the end of the program. First up, though, it's time to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Lara Dungan, immunologist, and physicist Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD. Our first story, Lara, has to do with walking again.
It does. And I really, really love this story. I think it's absolutely brilliant. So it's just been published from the University of Minnesota, and it's in Advanced Healthcare Materials. And we've talked an awful lot on the program in the past about spinal cord injury and how your spinal cord cells cannot naturally repair themselves. So if you have a severed spinal cord, it can't re-repair and you can't walk again. And there's a huge amount of research in lots of different areas that is looking into this really, really serious problem. And this new research, I think, is absolutely fascinating. So it is mixing stem cell research, which a lot of people have heard about. Stem cells are the cells from which all your body cells grow. So neurons are your brain cells and they come from stem cells. And it's mixing that with this materials technology in the form of 3D printing. So it's making these tiny little silicone, effectively railroads. They're sort of meshes of silicone railroads. And what they're doing is, so they're severing rat spinal cords, and then they're inserting this tiny little silicone mesh slash kind of railroad to help you picture it. And then they're putting the little neural stem cells on this. And it's sort of like if you can imagine like a really old 1940s movie where the bridge has collapsed in between the two different parts of the cliff. And they're sort of giving a direction for the stem cells to move across. And what they found is the stem cells are growing across this little bridge and they're rejoining essentially the two ends, the two severed ends of the spinal cord. Now, this is far from perfect. First of all, it's only in animals. It's only in rats. And secondly, these rats go from... So what they do when they're looking for movement is you have different grades of movement. So you would rate it from complete paralysis, which is essentially a zero, from up to kind of a flicker, which is what these rats would have after their spinal cords are severed. And what these rats after the experiment have is sort of uncoordinated, wobbly walking gait. But that is really fundamentally different from a flicker slash paralysis. So it's absolutely fascinating. Now, currently what happens is the little silicone mesh stays in. The plan is to make it in the future from a biodegradable material. So when the little spinal cord cells have grown across and rejoined like the bridge over the cavern, hopefully then the biodegradable material will sort of, I suppose, dissolve and disappear. But I just think this is really, really exciting research and such an innovative way to help target these little cells to tell them where they're going.
I have been doing this program for 15, 16 years now. I remember about 10, 12 years ago, people talking about using scaffolds and then implanting them with stem cells to regenerate bone, to regenerate tissue. This, I mean, in a way, this doesn't feel like particularly new as an idea. I guess it just takes a long time to develop the right material or the right approach to it structurally.
But isn't that fascinating though, Jonathan? That's the delay. So we see these things and we talk about them on the show and we say, someone's come up with a great idea and everyone goes, God, that's a great idea. Isn't it brilliant? And that is how long it actually takes. It takes 10 years. I mean, obviously I'm being, you know, facetious in the 10 years, but in general, to get these things from bench to bedside, it can take decades or more. Mm. That's exactly it. So it is the material okay? Does the material cause an immune reaction? If it causes an immune reaction, boom, you go back to the start. Is it stable? Can the cells grow on it? There's all these different things that you have to go through. And this is why things take a decade. And we look at this research and we think, great, that's brilliant. Spinal cords are fixed. And that's obviously not the case. But we are a decade closer than we were when we first talked about it on the show. And also 15 years, you are getting old, Johnny.
Yeah, I know. Thanks very much for pointing that out. in terms of... other, I don't know, this is probably not something I can ask you about on this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. You know, there was talk about doing different things to try and address spinal cord problems, such as building a sort of an electrical bridge that sort of connected over the divide. This is a very different approach. Is this, you know, the most promising research that we know of at the moment to address spinal cord repair?
There is a lot of very promising research, and that's why I think it's so fascinating, because it's one problem and people are tackling it from all these different angles. So you're exactly right. So in terms of like electrodes that are helping to grow the spinal cords back, then there's chemicals, then there's these types of materials. And when somebody who has never looked at this before comes at this from their background, so say they are 3D printing, they come up with these amazing ideas. And it is this universal problem, spinal cord injury, and it often affects young people, usually from road traffic accidents, these kind of things. So there's so many different approaches. It's not necessarily the most promising, but it is a really, really interesting approach. And like you said, it has been around for about 10 years.
Brilliant. Shane, our second story has to do with a constant ebbing and flowing of the debate around the AMOC. We covered this a few years ago, I think it was, and it seemed like a really bad story. Just give us the background before you tell us about this new piece of research.
Yeah, so the AMOC is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, but we'd know it as that large ocean current in the North Atlantic that carries warm water from the equator to the poles, and it returns cooled down. There's a big cycle in the ocean that goes from the surface right down to the depths of the ocean. And thank goodness for it, because without it, we wouldn't have our climate. Our climate is defined by this ocean circulation. So it means that in Ireland, we have temperate weather and we have warm water. I know you wouldn't think it when you get into the Atlantic Ocean, but it is relatively warm for its latitude. And there has been a lot of interest in the stability of this circulation of late because of the effects of climate change. So what's happening is that the polar regions are being disproportionately warmed in a warming world. And that's having an effect because the temperature difference between the equator and the pole isn't as great as it once was. And that temperature difference is the driver of the circulation. So scientists have been doing a lot of modeling and some amount of observation on this. It's very difficult physics to do because you're dealing with an extremely complicated system, and it's also very challenging to collect data. But nevertheless, there are very clever physicists and other types of scientists, I guess, that are able to do this work. And they have been publishing ever more alarming pieces of research in recent times. Now, we know that the AMOC is at its weakest it's at the weakest point it has been for 1600 years. And, you know, so there's an increased chance that it is weakening and that it may be going past some tipping point beyond which it will collapse inevitably. And until this study, it was thought that the chances of that collapse in the next century or two was around 10%. So a real risk, but a small risk relative to other, let's face it, certainties that we know about with climate change, like sea level rise. But this new modeling has looked over a larger time frame, and it looks at three conditions, or two conditions. One is just rising emissions, kind of not doing anything to curb emissions, that the temperature variation between pole and equator would continue to grow. And in 70% of all the model runs in that scenario, we see complete collapse, and we see that the tipping point for that collapse would happen within 10 to 20 years, most likely, right? So in other words, our kids and certainly their kids would not live in an Ireland that's temperate. That's quite alarming, I think, right?
Yeah. When
we think of all the other nonsense that goes on in the world about short-term things, that's very alarming. The good news is that if we stay within the Paris limits, the risk of collapse lowers to 25%.
But Paris is a pipe dream, really. You know, like that is if a best case scenario is 25%, you know, that we actually keep to Paris, which I just do not see happening. We're talking about a very, very near total change of our environment, as you say, for our grandchildren.
Yeah, or potentially even for us, right? You know, so like if the tipping point were to cross within 10 to 20 years, it's most likely that complete collapse would be within an additional 50 to 100 years. So we may live through a time where we'd start to see the effects of this. Certainly our children may. Now, I do stress, in case people are freaking out, that these are models. You know, there is a lot more work to be done. There is some degree of inconsistency in the modeling, and we need to scientifically figure that out. But it is trending in the wrong direction. And I guess, you know, these things are important, and we do need to have better data, better models, and pay attention to them.
Yeah. And as we see, you know, our neighbors across the Atlantic, you know, talking about removing environmental restrictions, like, we need to just look at the science here, because it's obviously not just this one study, but there are so many studies across so many different domains that's saying that we need to reduce our emissions. This is a one that has a fairly significant impact directly on us in a short space of time.
Yeah, more flippantly, I wouldn't be able to go swimming when I go on holidays to Cork.
Don't do that. Don't do that, Shane. Don't do that, Shane. Oh, my God. Like, we're talking about, you know.
Do you know what? I'm trying to lighten the mood.
Sometimes all you can do is laugh. Sometimes all you can do is laugh. Our third story has to do with aspirin, Lara. And as someone who is just about to turn 50, I've started to think a little bit more about my heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, and we all should be thinking about our health. And look, it's a little bit of good news, which is great, because Shane is definitely the downer of the day. So I'm going to bring good news. So there's new research that's just been brought out. It was actually presented at the European Society of Cardiology's meeting, and it's been published then at the same time in the Lancet Journal, which is a very big journal. And what they've done is they've looked back over all research trials that have involved using aspirin versus another drug called clopidogrel. So what these are antiplatelet drugs. So antiplatelet drugs stop clots, and clots are the things that form to cause essentially heart attacks and strokes. They block off arteries. And what they found from this research, looking at about 29,000 different patients in the past, is that people who were always canonically on aspirin, which is supposed to help for secondary prevention of these heart attacks and strokes, actually had a less good outcome than patients who were put just on clopidogrel, which is what lots of people will have heard of as Plavix. So this is not a massive surprise, in that when people are treated, for instance, when you get stents after a heart attack, you go on dual antiplatelet therapy, you go on both aspirin and clopidogrel. We know clopidogrel works, but the belief has always been in medicine that you can't give only clopidogrel. And this is 100 years of belief of aspirin going to every single person who's ever had a heart attack and a stroke. And it was believed that clopidogrel made you bleed, so you were more likely to have an adverse effect. And it also used to be more expensive, because it used to be on patent. So this research has shown there's actually a 14% reduction in your risk of heart attack or stroke if you're on clopidogrel only over aspirin. Nowadays, it's pretty much the same price, very marginally more expensive, but also you need to take into account that there's 14% less risk of heart attack or stroke. So that's going to reduce the risk overall. So this is actually really exciting. So people can now, obviously don't change, talk to your GP or your cardiologist. But the hope is that people will be able to switch on to clopidogrel in the long term and remove aspirin, which has usually got more side effects, and stay on that for life instead.
These tablets, you just take like one pill a day, is that the idea? And that thins out your blood a little bit, makes it less likely to block, is that the idea?
Yeah, effectively. So it stops your platelets from grouping together and causing clots. Yeah. And conveniently, it's exactly the same dose. They're both 75 milligrams. There's not even that much to remember. Once a day, nice and easy. But don't switch without asking your doctor.
Shane, our final story has to do with social media and banning social media. And it's very timely, because I just had a conversation with my son this morning about the amount of time he's spending on Snapchat and trying to manage that with him. So what is this all about?
Yeah, so in Australia, there's about to be the implementation of something called the Online Safety Amendment Act, effectively going to ban young people under the age of 16 from the various platforms like Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, etc. And this is all coming in the context of reports of increased adolescent mental health and anxiety have increased at the same time that the use of social media has increased. However, we've reported several times in the show that several longitudinal or long-term studies have yet to been able to show a causative effect from one thing and the other. But nevertheless, there's strong correlation. As somebody recently said to me, it's certainly a theory that's in search of evidence. But it's important for us to pay attention to these things. And the Australian government have responded with this act. And there was an amazing piece in Nature this week that said this is a fantastic opportunity for us to do a large-scale experiment to try and figure out what are the effects of this ban in Australia. And not just is it good, is it bad, but to understand the nuance. They're saying, however, that perhaps because of various political things in Australia, there has been a dearth of organization to get social science in gear to do the right work, to get the ethics and the consent, etc., to set up the studies. So they offer a couple of different things that they might be able to do, like looking at international comparisons between Australia, where the ban will be in force, and other countries where there won't be a ban. Looking at things like medical records from hospitals and coroners, looking at national surveys, piggybacking on existing longitudinal studies, including one called Future Proofing. And also saying that they really do need to be careful around the headline effects in large studies like this. This is an extremely complicated situation, and that things may go
paper
negative.
Comes out and people, people read a headline in a newspaper or listen to a radio program and go, I'm going to change what I'm going to do. But like, you know, when it comes to cigarette use, for example, you know, until there was a causal proof shown, people didn't make any restrictions on cigarettes. Although I'm sure a lot of people had a pretty good hunch, you know, until it was actually proven because of lobbying. And we see a huge amount of big tech lobbying at the moment, you know, waiting for a causal link, I think can be problematic in the case when you're talking about mental health.
Yeah, for sure. But smoking, there was causation from the 50s that it was happening. There's no causation. I'm not a defender of big tech, but there may be other factors, environmental and social, that are causing the rise in youth mental health.
No, absolutely they are. But I strongly believe, and it seems to be a good amount of evidence, that mental health and social media use are at least, there's a correlation there. And I think that's, it is something that I would err more on the side of caution. I don't think a ban is ever really a good idea. I don't think they work either. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Laura Duggan, thank you very much. For millions of years, our ancestors shuffled, scrambled, and swung their way through life on four limbs until something truly extraordinary happened. We stood up. But how did evolution actually pull off this feat of anatomical engineering? What had to change deep in our bones and our DNA to turn a climbing ape into a walking human? Well, here to discuss is Dr. Terence Cappellini. He's a chair of evolutionary biology at Harvard. Welcome to the program, Terence. It's great to have you on. Perhaps you might talk to us about the time before we started to walk. What was the shift or the niche that we were trying to fill that we decided that climbing and going around in all fours just wasn't good enough anymore?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jonathan. Thanks also for having me on the show. So I would say that initially, and there's some debate about this, but for the most part, our ancestors prior to the first bipedal walking species of past humans, these ancestors were forms that could climb, swing, and also do knuckle walking. That is, you walk on all fours, but use their forelimbs, their arms, to like help them move about. And so what happens during this window of time, which is between around 8 and 5 million years ago, is that there's some global cooling happening, and the forests are beginning to shrink, so they're becoming more patchy. And so they're becoming separated by larger tracts of grasslands. And it's argued that that's the impetus for having a form of locomotion that becomes more efficient, to walk between patches of forests. So what's the benefit of that? Well, you can carry. You can carry objects. You can carry offspring. You can look above the grass so you don't get eaten by a lion or a predator, other predators. So there's that kind of pressure to become more efficient locomotor.
Well, I mean, I know that evolutionary biology is sometimes looking at what we have and trying to see if we can fit the theory. But haven't offspring always kind of clung on to apes traditionally? Isn't that efficient enough? Is running on four legs a lot less efficient than running on two legs?
So running on two legs became over evolutionary time a much more efficient form of locomotion. So they've done experiments where they've taken our chimpanzees and they've tried to make them stand and walk upright, and their capacity, their oxygen consumption, their energetic capacity is much lower. They'll become less efficient at how they move across.
Sorry, this is a very interesting detail. How on earth did they do that?
There's old experiments where they placed chimpanzees on treadmills, and they looked at oxygen consumption to see how they were walking on when they're on all fours versus on twos. How they're moving, and they compared them to humans doing the same things. So
okay, yeah. So if you just put a chimpanzee standing up, that's no good. Our ability to run and walk on 2 feet has been perfected over years of evolution.
Yeah, and the initial changes were happening to an animal that didn't have long legs, you know, didn't have the body proportions that we have. They had proportions that were more ape-like. So there's this period of time where they're more facultative. They're walking in a way that they can also do swinging on trees. They can also do knuckle walking. They're not relying on bipedalism, but they become more reliant on bipedalism over the time, walking on two legs, that is.
Right. So before we started walking on two legs, most of the time we were able to do it. We just didn't do it a lot.
We just didn't do it a lot. And we were less capable, less efficient at it, arguably. We also, we started to do things like make tools and carry tools and be able to traverse larger distances where we might have had to carry even our offspring, but also tools and other objects for longer distances. So that might have been one of the benefits to standing on and walking on two legs.
Well, that's a good theory. I mean, marrying our tool use, disparate habitats, and our standing up. What sort of evidence have you got that this is actually what's happening? And which came first? Was it the hips changing, or was it the behavior changing?
Yeah, that's very hard to say. I mean, I think a lot of people would argue that the behavior probably changed a bit first. We can see apes, African apes, and even like gibbons, for instance, walking on two legs. They don't do it for long periods of time. Their preferred locomotion style is walking on all fours or swinging from the trees. So they're not doing it in an obligatory way. They're not obliged to do it. They can do it here and there. So I think the behavioral change probably came first, and it was coupled with environmental changes that made doing it over longer periods of time becoming more the preferred strategy. And then, of course, that would be facilitated by adaptations that arise in the limbs that allow the animal to do it more efficiently. And the pelvic changes are some of the earliest changes that we see.
So when you change something so dramatic, it's almost like, flippers to arms and legs, or, it's a very big change in an animal. Mm-hmm. Presumably behavior changes then, and then the body adapts to that. And then the follow on from the hips is the whole body, right? So can we see that in the fossil record? If we look at, the first ancestors that walked, how their body changes. Can you walk me through that?
Yeah. So there are fossils, back five, six million years ago, fossils that are have been argued to be on the future human lineage, the hominin human lineage, and those fossils have some evidence of bipedal locomotion. So, for instance, the upper part, the pelvic structures, seem to be the first parts that have changed. This part that we talk about in our research, the ilium, the upper part of the pelvis. That helps form the basin, the classic basin shape of a human skeleton. That upper part is some of the first parts that we see evidence of change in the fossil record.
Right.
Changes to knees and changes to the feet, they do occur, but much, much later in time. And there's debate about this, but generally, for the most part, the pelvic changes are the first types of changes that you see in the fossil record.
Right. And what about our genes then? Because our biology and our genetic code obviously are very closely intertwined. The physical anatomy, I mean, and our DNA are intertwined. Presumably, there needs to be a shift in how these genes behave when you have such a dramatic change in an animal, right?
Yeah, so we've been talking about this dramatic change. So what are these dramatic changes? Because that'll help us get to the genes. So the first thing that we kind of observed in the developing human skeleton is that the cartilage that lays down most bones, like the thigh bone, for instance, usually forms as like a rod in the same direction as the femur does, you know, and then eventually gets replaced by hard bone. So you get your hard, long femur bone. Well, the same thing happens with the upper part of the ilium in all the other primates and mouse models that we looked at. For instance, it forms as a rod of cartilage and then it gets replaced by bone and it gets longer and taller from head to tail.
So what you're saying is that the precursor to bones as they change in an evolving body is cartilage that later gets sort of evolved into a stronger, sturdier structure if that structure is benefiting the animal.
Yeah, and this is a big misconception out there that like bones take form in utero inside in the womb and that's what you see, but it's actually the cartilage that gets laid down first. And the cartilage forms a model that almost looks like the adult bone on some level, and that model that forms is very more plastic, more flexible to change, and so for a structure like the ilium in the humans, which it forms as initially like a rod, just like it would in chimpanzees. And the rod is kind of oriented from the head to the tail, from our heads towards tail. And essentially what happens in development is that this rod that forms from head to tail now starts to grow perpendicular. It just changes the orientation of growth. It actually flips 90 degrees in the way it forms. So no longer forms along the long axis, the future long axis of the bone. It grows in width. And it grows in width pretty remarkably. What we discovered is that there's many, many regions in the human genome that control that process. There's 300 plus regions in the genome. And the other thing to note here is that it's not really the genes that are changing that much. A gene, which is a region of the DNA that instructs the development of a protein, is often used by many cell types in the body. So you can't really change it too much without messing up its function in other cell types. But you can think about the gene as like a light bulb in the house. And you have different light switches. And you can have a light switch in the bathroom that turns on the light bulb in the bathroom, but it doesn't turn it on in the kitchen. That'd be kind of odd. And so the light switch that turns on the light bulb in the kitchen is doing a particular function. And what we discovered is that actually the switches that turn genes on and off that have changed the most over evolution, and that they're responsible for flipping this growth trajectory. And there's about 300 plus regions of the genome that really show evidence of human evolutionary change and cause this flip in the development of the cartilage growth zone.
You're talking about epigenetics, is that right?
Yeah, these are more epigenetic switches, but these are encoded in the DNA and they're inherited from parent to offspring.
Right, yeah. So the epigenetics are the sort of, as you say, the controls over genes that sort of, that's like control knobs. They can turn them up or down or off.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that affects then how the gene is expressed. And those then, of course, have filtered down effects on other genes, and they're all interlinked in that way, which is really interesting. You recently had a paper in looking at this and looking at the pelvis and why it was so important. One of the things that we think about a lot, of course, is about brain size and intelligence, and that's often linked to the pelvis because the pelvis is where the womb is and allows for a large brain. Can you talk to us a little bit about the relationship between our pelvis and our brain?
Yeah, it's a complicated history, but it's a fascinating history. So prior to our work, there is this notion that when the earliest ancestors started to walk on two legs, they were growing their pelvis in the same way a chimpanzee would grow their pelvis, that is tall from head to tail. And that would actually have created a birth canal, which was more oval shaped from front to back. So very, very narrow from side to side. And that narrowness, the extent of how narrow it was from side to side, really reflects another part, which is walking. So when you're walking, you want your hip joints to be not so far apart that you're lumbering, but close to each other so you're efficient. But if they're too efficient, that narrows the birth canal, and that makes it hard for a small or a large fetal head to pass through.
Right.
And so evolutionarily, when the first ancestors started walking, their pelvis were relatively narrow, but still now circular rather than ovular, rather than oval. And that was fine because at the time our brain sizes were very small. We still had brain sizes about the size of a chimpanzee, about 350 to 400 cubic centimeters. But over evolutionary time, so when you get to around 1.5 million years ago, 1 million years ago, so really close, more closely to modern humans, brain sizes shot up. They went up to 1,000 cubic centimeters or 1,500 cubic centimeters, four times the size of a chimpanzee. And that's where that that circularness versus ovularness made a difference. There's other changes that happened as well. Like, for instance, we started probably developing a rotational system of how we're getting our fetus out of the body. We started to rotate the fetus through the birth canal to get it out. But it's a very complex relationship between the efficiency of walking and being able to fit a large-brained fetus through that birth canal.
And it's so, you know, it's really interesting when you think of all these little things that are related to each other, that one thing has a consequence of another. And the fact that evolutionarily, obviously, it made sense for us to give birth to babies that couldn't fend for themselves, and where it didn't suit other animals. And all of these trade-offs makes evolution such a fascinating subject to spend 15 minutes talking about on this program. And I've really enjoyed doing that with you. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Terence D. Capellini, who's chair of evolutionary biology at Harvard. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now to some of your comments from last week's program. We were speaking to Dr. Sharif El-Shakawi, who is a lecturer in prosthodontics, which is a new word for me. He's at the Faculty of Dental, Oral and Craniofacial Sciences at King's College London. Craniofacial, love it. He was talking about how he has isolated a protein from hair, essentially keratin, and that could be great for brushing our teeth because it can restore enamel. How long does fluoride remain active after brushing? Not very long is the thing. So if you go into the dentist, they will stick a bit of fluoride and tell you not to brush. So typically, if you you want to get the full benefit of fluoride, Sharif says, do not rinse afterwards. MN Dunleary says, I can't wait to use my own hair and my toothpaste, Jonathan, for the novelty alone. Yeah, I'm not sure you're going to be able to use your own hair. Well, I suppose you could DIY it, MacGyver it, I suppose. But the idea is to isolate the protein and then just put that into a toothpaste that you don't even notice, but it actually has restorative powers. That's the idea. Loads of questions on this one. How do the processing methods differ from using human hair compared to sheep wool, cost efficiency, etc.? I have no idea. I would imagine they're not going to use human hair for a number of reasons for this particular product, but I think sheep wool probably would be a good suggestion because it can often be a byproduct. But human hair, I don't think, well, technically you could, and that's why we use it as a hook. I think in reality, it's unlikely that people are going to buy a product if they know someone else's human hair was used to make it. I know I wouldn't. I'm not sure about you, though. Maybe you would. Maybe you'd love that. Maybe you're a weirdo. That's it from us in this week's podcast. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, as always, the queen of science radio. Rory Galvin, Hugo da Silva, Scott on sound. We'll thank you for listening again. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday, where we talk about misophonia, which is the fear of, it's more like the immense dislike of the sounds that other people make. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.